Christina Lake Cannabis is using proprietary outdoor genetics to grow and harvest cannabis in Western Canada. And with a 99-acre expansion, production should increase from nearly 72,000 pounds to a harvest capacity of over 194,000 pounds of high-quality, refined cannabis to extract exceptional THC and CBD oils. This cannabis highlight has been brought to you by Christina Lake Cannabis, U.S. trading symbol CLCFF and the Canada CLC. ChristinaLakeCannabis.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network, and I welcome my colleague and long informant of the economy, John Tamney, the editor of Real Clear Markets, in addition to other distinguished publications. However, it is the author, John Tamney, I welcome, with his new book, When Politicians Panicked, The New Coronavirus, Expert Opinion, and a Tragic Lapse of Reason. Mr. Tamney, congratulations. I take you immediately to the day itself for New York City, where I live and work. This is March 20th, 2020. The announcement from the governor of New York, Mr. Cuomo. He says that he is closing down New York. When I talk about the most drastic action we can take, this is the most drastic action we can take. We're going to take it to the ultimate step, which is we're going to close the valve. The governor is thinking of the economy as a valve that opens and shuts. He then orders a mandated shelter in place. He then orders a mandated closure for any business not in compliance with the governor's orders to shut down, to lock down. He adds, your actions can affect my health. That's where we are, he stated, said the governor. The question at that point was, how long? That question wasn't answered that day. There was the impression it was not a lengthy shutdown. It was, however, a severe contraction immediately. Mr. Tamney, March 20th, 2020, for New York City. I report that New York City is largely still under the governor's order of essential, non-essential, of distancing, of how many people can be in a restaurant at the same time, of how many people can be in a movie theater, how many people can gather. And the office towers, as you know very well, Mr. Tamney, are still largely shut. There's some volunteer return. There's more planned for April and May, perhaps a opening up of the office towers in September, but New York remains closed. John, what explains right now the severe contraction of our economy? Was it that day? Was it before? How to explain it to people who have either been without work or had their work severely limited this last year? Good evening to you, John.
Well, very clearly it was that day, because suddenly businesses that had become successful by virtue of meeting the needs of customers were basically told, you no longer can do that. You can no longer evolve with a different time. Because remember, before that, it's not as though cities and states across the U.S. hadn't adjusted. In truth, and as the New York Times pointed out, it was the red states that adjusted the most, because they were locked down last, as in people on their own got to work, started changing how their businesses were operated, started changing how often they went into businesses. What spooked the markets was suddenly that this ability for individuals who don't need a law to avoid death or sickness suddenly had their ability to manage that taken from them. And so with these forced lockdowns, panic set in. Politicians panicked, and this created nationwide panic.
Peter Thiel, the venture capitalist, as you describe him, wrote in a 2014 book entitled Zero to One, "The value of a business today is the sum of all the money it will make in the future." What about that day, John? What did that do to the value of the businesses in New York City, in Philadelphia, in Chicago, in San Francisco? That day, what did it do, John, and is it still with us?
That day, what it did is it forced investors to rethink what's the future for them. Because government showed in how quickly it could wreck an economy in very short order. Let's never forget that California, if it were a state, if it were a country, would be the world's fifth largest economy. Texas, if it were a state, would be the world's 10th largest economy. Throw New York in, what it means for the global economy. Illinois, suddenly the largest economy in the world by far was a quarter shut down. And so it had implications for businesses, U.S.-based businesses, but businesses around the world. If we're valuing them and all the dollars that are in the future, we have to rethink that given the ability of politicians to, in very short order, take away their ability to operate. And so there was a very quick correction in the market, understandably so. No one ever expected when March began that this is what politicians were going to do.
John, was the virus in the market before March 20th? Had the market taken into account the news such as we had from China?
Unquestionably it had. Because let's never forget, people can have positive and negative views about China, but what they cannot deny is that U.S. businesses, particularly the best ones, have major exposure to the Chinese markets. Apple, the most valuable business in the world, sells a fifth of its iPhones in China. GM sells more cars in China than it does in North America. China is the largest market ex the U.S. for McDonald's and Nike. It's Starbucks has 4,100 stores there. And my point with that is that we knew from market signals from China that the virus was many things, but it wasn't very lethal. And we knew that long before March, because had it been killing the Chinese indiscriminately, this would have shown up in collapsing U.S. equity prices to reflect that the best market for U.S. companies other than the United States was suddenly dying before our eyes. But in truth, those companies I described saw their shares hitting all-time highs while the virus was spreading rampantly in China. Again, a signal that it was many things, none of them terribly lethal.
I have notes from your book, John. Late January 2020, Farhad Manjoo, the distinguished columnist for the New York Times, writes that the late January virus is a response, perhaps is an overreaction, late January. On February 29th, a month later, the New York Times editorial says there's more fire drill than fire in reports of the virus from overseas. In early March of 2020, I recall this day, the mayor of New York, Mr. de Blasio, who was in sympathy with the New York Times editorial, who was in sympathy with Farhad Manjoo, so I'm not presuming that the mayor made a mistake here. He's following along with the wisdom of the moment. Takes a ride in the subway to tell people that it's safe, and there's a photograph of him in all the tabloids. That's either March 5th or March 6th that it happened. And then, John, what we have is a cancellation of South by Southwest in Texas. You find that significant, John. What was going on? Were there contradictory events happening in February and March?
No question there were. Let's never forget that Donald Trump said the virus is no big deal, but so did Vogue editor Anna Wintour. It's not just that de Blasio rode the subway. He also told New Yorkers to go to the movies, to live their lives. No one took this very seriously, and that's the point. Despite months of evidence coming out of China, and so we knew from China that it wasn't something that it was terribly lethal. It'd been in the news and everything, and so people were acting calmly. Then Austin, Texas. This is Texas. The mayor shuts down South by Southwest, which is Black Friday in many ways for Austin. And I think that's when investors started to get religion that, wait a second, if Texas can shut things down this quickly, what will other states do? And so the market started to correct based on, okay, this is going to get much worse, but it's going to get worse because of political action, not because of what was happening in the real world.
You note that three very large states and their governors, March 22nd, shut down. This is 2 days after Mr. Cuomo's announcement in New York. Governor Pritzker of Illinois, shutting down. Governor Cuomo of New York, shutting down. Governor Newsom of California, locking down. Texas followed a week later, March 31st. I mention that because that is understood as a non-blue state, a red state, the state of Texas. John, was that in the market between March 22nd and March 31st? Did the market expect those governors to act in such a fashion?
Yes. At this point, it was a known quantity. And so the markets corrected most right up to March 23rd as they digested what was going to happen. And so there's your market correction. Surprise, oh, wow, they're actually going to do this. And then markets started to rebound. Now, I tie it to information that started to come out from not just the Wall Street Journal, a publication, its editorial page seen as right-wing, but stuff coming from the New York Times, both very clearly saying, once again, that the virus was many things, but it wasn't some kind of mass indiscriminate killer. David Katz knew that in the New York Times from following what had happened in South Korea. The Wall Street Journal knew it from Raj Bhattacharya, who wrote about it for them, talking about how what we're seeing in Italy is vastly overstating the lethal aspect of the virus. And so I think markets started to revive based on the assumption that, yeah, this is going to end. It has to end because, again, it's many things. It's making some sick, but it's not going to kill off a big number of Americans.
I'm speaking to John Tamney. His new book is When Politicians Panicked, The New Coronavirus, Expert Opinion, and a Tragic Lapse of Reason. We've drawn a line in a calendar, March 20th to 22nd to 23rd of 2020. The crisis is at hand. The markets are accounting for it. But what about the politicians? And what about the business of America is business? When we come back, I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network. John Tamney, the columnist, the editor, and now the author, John Tamney, When Politicians Panic, The New Coronavirus, Expert Opinion, and a Tragic Lapse of Reason. The markets have now reacted, late March of 2020, but government is getting into the contest. Government in the states, Mr. Cuomo, Mr. Pritzker, Mr. Newsom, and the other governors, have issued orders. It is not clear at this point to the American people that these orders are going to be enforced by police power, although the state governments have that option, the city governments have that option. It looks that the governors are counting on Americans to do the right thing. For how long is an open question. There are different expectations. But at no point, and Mr. Tamney, I check with you on this because my memory is dim, and your book states very clearly that the governors indicated early on that this would not last a long time. Did they give a timeline, John, how long the lockdowns?
They talked certainly about 2 weeks. That was the word because the view was if people will go and hide for 2 weeks, that will flatten the curve and that will give hospitals the time to adjust. But as we know throughout history, once you hand over that kind of power to someone else, it's rarely given back, and it certainly wasn't in this instance.
I only know New York City because I was walking the canyons by myself in late March, April, May, by myself, John. The American public responded to the experts, and you roll out the experts. I don't fault them, John. They don't have crystal balls. They go on models. They go on expectations. There were a lot of contradictory remarks about the virus, what it would do, who was most vulnerable. You don't fault them either, John. The puzzle is why it was the experts who became the leaders of the economy. There's the mystery you've raised, John. Was it obvious in late March that the economy was going to have to obey the expert epidemiologists, the expert disease control speakers from Washington? Did people think, well, I'm going to have to wait till the experts speak before I know what my businesses were?
I think they started to realize that. And that's when the crisis began, in a sense. And that's when the economic crisis began. You put it well. I don't fault the experts. As you pointed out before, we've talked, what are newspapers but the first draft of history? Well, so is expert opinion in many ways, the first draft of what's ahead. Let's go back to the AIDS scare in the 1980s. No less than Anthony Fauci wrote a paper saying that AIDS could be easily spread just by a husband to his wife standing in the same room. How little we knew. It turns out he was incorrect. doesn't make him a bad person. That's what he had to work with based on limited information. And so in this case, once again, we're working based on limited information. We have information from China, once again, indicating that it wasn't an indiscriminate killer, but we don't know much. And so when you then empower experts to make so many decisions for so many people, you logically create crisis. It becomes self-fulfilling. It may be that Anthony Fauci, if he went to a Yankees game, because he's a baseball fan, would be the smartest person in Yankee Stadium. But all the fans in that stadium would collectively be smarter than Fauci. And what I've just described is markets at work. Why do they work so well? Because they bring in the knowledge of everyone. And so suddenly we were substituting broad knowledge in the proverbial marketplace of humanity for very few people. Hence crisis, hence mass unemployment, hence mass business death. We added central planning on top of political decrees.
John, let us take an example of a pandemic and a different world reaction. You point to December of 1968. I'm old enough to remember December of 1968. I was at university. And a flu, not a coronavirus, but a flu came from, well, at the time we said Hong Kong. Who knows where it came from? But in any event, the analysis afterwards was that it came home with soldiers returning from the Vietnam War. And it spread very quickly in December of 68 through the winter of 69. I remember being very ill in February of 1969, and I was very young, and with my immune system was very powerful. You have statistics here that say that there were 100,000 American deaths with that flu in the winter of 69 into the springtime. And if we use that number, 100,000 in 1968, that's the equivalent of 250,000 deaths today, given the size of the population. Mostly it was over 65, people who were over 65, similar to what the coronavirus makes most vulnerable. What was the reaction of the markets, John, to your research, and to the politicians at the time to your research, John? How did they react?
The markets didn't react at all because life went on. And politicians couldn't much react. There were in small instances school closures, but no one could really do anything, and we all know why. Everyone's job 50 years ago was a destination. If you had shut down the economy 50 years ago, there would have been mass riots such that it would have been reopened probably within a day, maybe less than that. Politicians could not do what they did because there was no Zoom, there was no internet, there was no Peapod or different grocery stores that could deliver things to your door. There were no, quote, as I put it in the book, subhumans to deliver restaurant food to your door that, of course, elite Americans said, don't knock on the door, just leave it on the doorstep. There was no way for people to have stream videos back then. There were not even Blockbuster nights. So lockdowns would have meant great discomfort for everyone. And so politicians logically did nothing. If you'd been walking New York 50 years ago, the canyons would have been very full because people were going to have to get on with their lives. And so you hit on something very important that I talk about a lot in the book, that, again, what happened could have only happened in modern times.
John, there's a puzzle. We'll take it, the chicken and egg problem, and we're not going to solve it today. Did we lock down because we had to, or did we lock down because we could? There it is, John. Technology gave us a tool, and we used it, not thinking through the consequences of using such a powerful tool. Next time, because we have to or because we can. We're going to turn to what happened in 2020, because though the state governments weighed in with their flatten the curve or 2 weeks or a momentary to disrupt the rise of the virus to allow our hospitals to catch up, the national politicians had much bigger plans, sometimes known as a command economy. When politicians panic, John Tanner. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network, and my conversation with the author, John Tamney, his new book, When Politicians Panicked, the new coronavirus, expert opinion, and a tragic lapse of reason. It is now late March, early April, and Washington is engaged. The 20th century called it command economy. I don't believe that word was used in April in any negative fashion, but it was the same. The economy of the United States was about to be nationalized, admittedly half-heartedly, but the effect is still with us. John, no such thing as government investment, and yet that's how it was presented. No such thing as government picking winners, and that's how it was protected. In addition, John, there's no such thing as a government choosing who's going to lose if we don't intervene. That's what happened. You have a wonderful quote from Adam Smith, 1776 Adam Smith, that careful Scotsman, that capital increases with parsimony, capital decreases with profligacy. What happened in the spring of 2020, John, in the national government?
Well, the national government, after causing and subsidizing a national economic collapse, decided that it was going to throw trillions of dollars at it. Basically, command and control was imposed such that the U.S. economy was in desperate shape and businesses were dying and individuals losing their jobs, at which point the very politicians who had enabled local and state politicians to wreck things so thoroughly threw $2.9 trillion at it. They were basically going to try to save with money the businesses and jobs they destroyed. What they did is they just naturally delayed the recovery, because in a normal economic situation, a virus is spreading. Maybe people do get scared. Maybe people stop consuming. Maybe people stop going out. Probably some businesses die based on that. But the savings sets the stage for the rebound, as in suddenly the parsimony sets the stage. It creates more capital for businesses to access to rebound. In this case, politicians hoovered it up and just threw it indiscriminately at what they broke.
You name a Harvard professor, Jason Furman, who I believe was in the Obama administration as an advisor, a counselor. And he wrote a column about this time, which in effect said, rain cash on the American people. John, can government giving out checks, and eventually, I don't recall, there were $1,400 or $1,200 checks, they've moved the number around, and providing extra money to those who were disenfranchised, unemployed, during the forced contraction of the economy in New York City and everywhere else across the country. Can giving money to those people stimulate the economy? Does it work that way, John, that we'll get growth if we hand out cash? Because that's what Mr. Furman believes.
No, it doesn't. It very clearly doesn't. If it worked, it would have worked in the past. If it worked, West Virginia would be a booming economy today, because politicians have been throwing the money of others at West Virginia for decades with no success. And so Furman got it exactly backwards. What you need to grow an economy is investment. You need to match investment with talented, innovative people. So right when the economy needed investment, it needed intrepid capital being directed toward businesses that had been impaired by government error, Furman, and to be fair, Republicans, were calling for massive government spending. Basically, shift precious capital from those with the most, those most capable investing, yes, I'll say it, the rich, and hand it off to those most capable of consuming. Well, consumption, once again, doesn't drive economic growth. See West Virginia. What drives it is investment, yet the political class hoovered away trillions of dollars from those most capable in the form of treasury borrowing that naturally delayed what would have been a much quicker recovery.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, the distinguished columnist and blogger and commentator for the New York Times, he keeps deal book, said that it was necessary to nationalize U.S. investment. What does that mean, John? What can you nationalize an investment class?
He thought so. He thought naively. He literally was calling for the federal government to spend $10 trillion basically lending to all businesses, so that they would keep 90% of their employees. Basically try, and so think about what this means. On its own, what is our economy? And I don't believe in GDP, but let's just say it's $16, $17 trillion economy. He wanted government to become a size investor, allocating over half of the size of the economy. So on its own, it fails. We know this from the 20th century. But let's remember also, the reason the U.S. economy is the most dynamic in the world, and this is something you and I have been discussing for years now, is that businesses die all the time. Silicon Valley is the richest region in the world, not because all of its businesses succeed, but precisely because the vast majority of them fail. We have no sacred cows in the U.S. economy. And so no matter what happened, with or without the virus, with or without political panic, lots of businesses were going to die in 2020. That's just what happens every year. Yet Sorkin and the political class, Republican and Democrat, were basically calling on government to freeze in place the economy, just prop up everything indiscriminately without regard to whether it has any future as a way to save the economy. Well, I submit to you, based on logic and history, that is the exact way to wreck an economy.
Suddenly, John, you remind me of Marcus Aurelius. You can't step into the same river twice. You're making me think metaphorically the economy is a river, and that the recommendation from these senior commentators in the spring of 2020 was stop the river. Stop the river. Don't let the river fall. Nothing. Now, the stimulus package was passed, CARES Act. Money was distributed. You write that it was anti-investment. How so, John?
Well, it's anti-investment because anything that aims to stimulate consumption logically deprives those most capable of investing of putting the capital to work. And so as a rule, when you shift trillions of dollars from those with the most, again, the rich, that they have the ability to invest and put it in the hands of the consumers, yeah, they're going to buy things, but that doesn't stimulate economic growth. That just freezes in place. It just deprives the economy of the investment necessary for it to grow.
You entertain a thought experiment. What if the politicians had done nothing? And you point us to John Delgado, who works for FarmShare and lived, I don't know, up to 60 days in a tent. What does that illustrate to you, John, a man living in a tent, and compare that to what if the politicians had done nothing?
Well, it's an important distinction because Delgado not only was living in the tent, but he was doing so in Florida. He was working in a food cooperative in Florida. And so Florida was, again, one of the states that closed last and opened very quickly. But he was fearful of his family. He had a big family. And so each day at work, he wore a mask. And when he came home, rather than interact with his kids or interact with his wife, he slept in a tent because he feared in going to work that maybe he was going to be exposed to the virus. Now, it's a reminder that he did this in a state where there were no such requirements foisted on the people. He did it, and it's a reminder that we don't need a law generally to avoid that which might kill us or that which might make us ill. And so if politicians do nothing, are we really so naive as to presume that Americans were just going to blithely go about their lives and not care about getting potentially very sick or maybe in certain instances dying? I mean, the very question answers itself. But think about what also happens if they do nothing. Americans would have adjusted on their own because they don't like to get sick or die. But that reduced spending would have caused near-term difficulties for business, but it would have also created massive capital formation for businesses to borrow, to seek investment. Again, businesses never die of lack of money. What they die of is a lack of investor trust. And so if investors could have seen them in April of 2020, yeah, you're struggling, but the future is bright. We're going to get on from this. They would have very readily on their own in private fashion put money to work in businesses small and large precisely because there would have been lots of capital waiting there for them to do just that.
You cite Holman Jenkins, the distinguished columnist for The Wall Street Journal, who has an anecdote that's wonderful. Hand sanitizer disappeared before Berlin shut down. The people were not waiting for politicians to announce problems. They took it upon themselves. I remember the toilet paper disappeared weeks before there were shutdowns across Europe. Weeks, John. Weeks. Now, wonderful, John. The politicians acted. In other words, they did something. However, what they did is a puzzle. And when we come back, we're going to turn to the decisions, the payroll protection program, the investment in private business from the Federal Reserve, especially the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve seeking to rally the markets with assurances of low interest rate. The book is When Politicians Panicked, The New Coronavirus, Expert Opinion, and a Tragic Lapse of Reason from John Tanley. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network. And John Tamney, his new book, When Politicians Panicked, The New Coronavirus, Expert Opinion, and a Tragic Lapse of Reason. John, two examples you provide about the Payroll Protection Program and the grants to businesses. Sidwell Friends, the distinguished private school in Washington, with an endowment, I think, more than $50 million, received $5.2 million from the government programs, the combination of them. The John Burroughs School of St. Louis received another distinguished private school, received $2.55 million. There are many examples of excesses, people who apply. But the Payroll Protection Program, did it work, John? Does government have an opinion of it today? Because, as we know, they continue to vote more and more money to be handed out to their idea of who needs it.
If something worked because maybe it saved a few businesses, sure, perhaps. But that's not a worthy way of looking at it, because we always have to ask what businesses died, what businesses never got funding, because government was just indiscriminately propping up anything that had an effective strategy for going online and asking for PP money and working through a bank that was well tied to the government and was able to get that money out to them. Again, we'll never know what would have been otherwise, and it would have been much better, because rather than government as the allocator indiscriminately propping up private schools, propping up Harvard, propping up the Los Angeles Lakers, we would have had actual market forces at work.
The Federal Reserve had its own version of PPP. I think it was called Main Street Lending, providing large sums of money to businesses to stay open. It appears, John, a year later, that there was much, much attention to jobs, to the loss of jobs, than there was to the value of sustaining businesses that were troubled or permitting businesses to sustain themselves. An example, John, that you use throughout the book is restaurateurs were inventive, when they were allowed to be, about what made their customers feel safe in the time of the virus. But the Federal Reserve Program and the PPP, they didn't allow individual businesses. I believe I've read this in your book. They didn't allow individuals to make their own adjustments to their clientele. They mandated them, and then they pushed cash at them. John, what business wouldn't take cash being pushed at it, but what is the cost of that cash that was pushed to businesses that were not allowed to adjust for themselves? What are we paying for, John?
Well, we're paying for it, for one, because their credit is still impaired. That's the first thing. But the second thing is, we know from 2008, you and I go so far back, we know that whenever government gives money out, it doesn't do so without strings attached. When are they going to come back and demand other kinds of behavioral changes based on this? Again, imagine if they'd done nothing. Businesses still would have been able to attract funding. It just wouldn't have been the government doing so indiscriminately. In an economy like ours, their businesses will fail all the time. And so what we did is we slowed the natural process whereby we work out what's good and what's bad. I mean, think about if the coronavirus had come along in the year 2000. The Fed view was that we want to fund well-capitalized companies. Well, as we found out from the Fed's Main Street Lending Program, well-capitalized companies didn't need it and didn't want it. They didn't want those strings attached. But think back to 2000. Would Amazon have been funded? Probably not. Remember, it's Amazon.org. Apple was near bankruptcy back then, and people like Michael Dell were saying, let's just put it out to pasture. It serves no purpose anymore. Netflix certainly would not have gotten funding back in 2000. It was such a joke that even Blockbuster had opportunities to buy it and would not take it. And so when government's the indiscriminate funder of things, as a rule, it's going to miss out the future, but it's also going to prop up the past. And if you prop up the past, you weaken the economy.
John, do we have a constitutional right to work? Is there an answer to that question?
I am not a constitutional lawyer, but in Chapter 17, it's my most experimental chapter in the book, I make an argument that, in fact, we do. If you go back to Lochner v. New York from the early part of the 19th century, large bakeries got a law on the books in New York that limited the amount of hours that individuals could work in small bakeries. It was an anti-competitive measure.
This is Lochner v. New York, 1905. Please continue, John. Yes.
Yeah, in 1905. And so if you look back on that, the Supreme Court said, wait a second, the right to contract, the individual right to contract is very clearly protected by the Constitution. And so they struck down this New York law that limited the ability of people to work. And I think it applies to today. What about our, as individuals, I do believe that we have a right to contract. We have a right to go back to work regardless of what cities and states say. If we want to do it, if we feel comfortable doing it, that should be our right. But in this case, it was taken from us. Cities and states across the country said, no, if you operate your business, we'll cut off electricity to you. We will make life very difficult for you.
I can recall reports from Los Angeles, Mayor Garcetti, threatening to cut off water and power to residents who were demonstrating that they wanted to have a party and didn't obey social distancing and masking. It was a very peculiar threat, John. Maybe it happened, but it was not unusual to hear similar threats in other cities. Certainly in New York, there was always the anxiety about police power. We've heard stories from overseas. It's not the United States, but I remember one vividly of two women headed to the beach to have tea together. This is during one of the lockdowns in Great Britain. And they were detained and fined because it was believed that they were making light or in some way working around the mandates to sit on the facing the ocean, John, and enjoy tea and conversation. That was not social distancing. John, here we are, and it's not done yet. We're in 2021. There's suggestion of reopening. There are also new variants of the virus that are equally threatening. Have we learned, John? It's too early to have one conclusion, but you've written a whole book about what we did wrong in 2020. Do you see improvement in 2021?
I think we have. I think you put it so well last summer, and of course I talk about it in the book. We're seeing signals that the American people have learned never again. You pointed out from Los Angeles, the fireworks, the politicians shut down fireworks shows in Southern California so Californians staged their own. I don't think we'll ever allow this to happen again. I think that there is such resentment against what politicians did so indiscriminately. And then also, I think we've learned that you can never trust them based on a two-week thing, and so we won't allow that. But I think we're also wiser to the basic truth that I pound on throughout the book, that if a virus threatens, the most important answer to it is economic growth. Economic growth is the biggest foe of death and disease the world has ever known. We know this from the 19th century, back when if you broke your femur, you had 1 in 3 chances of death. If you broke your hip, you're going to die. If you got cancer, you were certainly going to die, but most didn't die of cancer because tuberculosis and pneumonia got them first. What was the common denominator? What changed? Why are we living so much longer today? Why are we dying of old age? It's because of economic growth that produced the resources necessary for doctors and scientists to basically turn yesterday's killers into today's afterthoughts. And so hopefully we've woken up to the answer that economic growth and freedom are the only answer to when something threatens.
Private enterprise, John. Let's run them up the flag. Pfizer didn't take any Operation Warp Speed money and produced a vaccine. Others did, but the vaccines were amazing, John, a product of private enterprise. Those risky pharmaceutical companies rode to the rescue far ahead of the predictions in June of 2020. The Lancet Journal said it would be 10 years before we had a good virus. Fauci believed 18 months, and here a vaccine. And here it is, John. So credit to private enterprise and their investors. Do I say correctly, John?
Yes, I think you said correctly. I didn't like how it was done. I think it could have been done more effectively without government money. But unquestionably, we saw again that, as you point out, private enterprise came to the rescue. So if you want people to be healthy, don't wreck the economy. Leave people alone. Leave enterprise alone, because that is the only way to keep people healthy, to come up with answers to that which might make us ill or, in certain instances, kill us.
I think, John, you're aware of the fact that everybody listening to you right now heard you very clearly, except the politicians. You accept that, John, don't you? That when this happens again, the politicians will panic. That's how we know they're politicians.
Yes, and it's such an important point, which is why I make the argument in the book over and over again that while the statistics support us, the New York Times pointed out over and over again that nearly half of the U.S. deaths associated with the virus were associated with nursing homes.
Right.
There's all these statistics that support our argument that, wow, why did you overreact? I say they're all weak. The only answer, always, first and last, in the middle, is freedom. Never again do that. Never again take away people's freedom has to be the only answer, because if not, we know that other viruses will come along, and we know that experts will easily gull politicians the next time. So we must have a ready-made answer in place. Do not take away the freedom of people.
John Tamney, the book is When Politicians Panicked. I'm John Batchelor.
Christina Lake Cannabis is using proprietary outdoor genetics to grow and harvest cannabis in Western Canada. And with a 99-acre expansion, production should increase from nearly 72,000 pounds to a harvest capacity of over 194,000 pounds of high-quality, refined cannabis to extract exceptional THC and CBD oils. This cannabis highlight has been brought to you by Christina Lake Cannabis, U.S. trading symbol CLCFF and the Canada CLC. ChristinaLakeCannabis.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.